like to inspire ourselves, each other, and, you know, our audiences, of course. And it's more so inspiring, you know, just having somebody to understand what you're going through. It's a connection that we have with the audience. I think that helps us a lot.
And do we hear that style that you're talking about on the Christmas album?
Yes. In the Christmas album, we have I'll Be Home for Christmas, and we have some fun songs. We have the Chipmunk song. And a lot of people don't get to see our silly side. That's definitely one of the songs that we get to be ourselves. Ooh,
Christmas time is here. Time for toys and time for cheer. We've been good, but we can't last. Hurry, hurry, Christmas, hurry fast.
We are still fun, you know, we're still joyous, and we don't really get to show that side a lot. And so we wanted to just delve into that side of ourselves for this project.
Was there a moment when you realized that you, I mean, that a cappella just was the right way to go for you guys?
Probably not until the sing-off, honestly. Mm-hmm. I feel like we were just doing it just to do it in college. And then the sing-off, it helped us hone our talents and our focus, and it made us realize what we actually can do, you know, just by ourselves.
You won season 2 of The Sing-Off on NBC. Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear a little bit from the show. This is Apologize.
You tell me that you need me, then you go and cut me down. But wait, you tell me that you're sorry, didn't think I'd turn around and say, hey, I said it's too late to apologize.
Those aren't young women screaming for you in the audience there, are they?
Most definitely. Barely.
Well, I mean, one of the judges on the show is Sean Stockman from Boys to Men. What was it like singing in front of someone who I understand is one of your idols?
Yeah, for sure. He's definitely been an inspiration for us over the years. I mean, to be honest, I didn't really listen to a lot of R&B when I was younger, but the few songs I did hear were actually Boys to Men songs. And to have him in the audience and to have his reactions be so over the top, like he was just falling over the tables, like, what? Like, these guys? Like, that was surreal.
And we sang with him. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, we did sing with him.
There's a sexiness to Boys to Men songs. Mm-hmm. Does trying to mimic their style in some ways take you to a place where you don't want to go?
We're Christians, but I mean, I like to say that we're sexy as well.
Yeah. Sexy and saved.
I say so much.
Sexy and saved. That may be the name of the next album?
Maybe.
I feel like, you know, we can. It's not a bad thing to be sexy as long as it's not something that you're trying to sell sex. You know, we're just being ourselves more so.
It's not our fault if you know, it's sexy.
Natural, you know.
I mean, fearfully and wonderfully made.
Well, I mean, being sexy and saved, I guess, you know, I mean, you're gospel singers at your core. You're men who came up through the church.
Right.
Is there this pressure to keep the music clean and positive?
This is DJ. I don't really feel that there's any pressure to keep our music clean. You know, when we wake up every morning and we just think about music, it's what comes out of us, what comes out of our mind, what comes out of our heart. And it's not unclean music. We don't want to sing that kind of stuff. We try not to listen to it.
Yeah.
So I think it's easier to go and kind of stay true to who you are than to go the opposite and sing that stuff. So I think it's easier and the pressure is not very heavy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you see too much, I don't know, selling sex today in the industry?
Entirely too much.
I feel like it's more of that than there is actual singers.
Yeah.
Like people just crawling around stage or like, I mean, just putting out videos and just the song itself may be about sex, but there's not actually singing in it. It's just, I don't really know what it is. I mean, it does what it does. They get their money.
It sells.
It sells, you know.
Sex sells.
I mean, I feel like real singing is a lost art.
Mm. Well, we have this rare treat. You guys were willing to do some songs right there in our New York studios. So hit me with a little bit of Do You Hear What I Hear?
Sure.
All right. 1, 2, 3. Said the king to the people everywhere, listen to what I say, listen to what I say. Pray for peace, people. to what I say. Listen to what I say. Oh, a child, a child. Sleeping in the night, he will bring us goodness and light. He will bring us goodness and light.
That is amazing.
Thank you.
I can't believe that there are no musical instruments there. It's only
our voices.
I mean, Christmas albums, there is something cliche about it. Yeah. Some people say every single musician does a Christmas album. How do you make it different?
Think out of the box.
Yeah.
And don't be scared to do it. Just kind of say, you know, let's go against the grain and just kind of do it. Mm-hmm. You know, arrangement-wise and creativity-wise.
Absolutely. This is Maurice. Committed, we just have this unique sound, you know. With our voices and, like DJ said, our creativity, it just makes it different.
Well, let's end this interview in the right way and hear one more song from the new album, Home for Christmas. Can you guys do a little nativity medley for us there in the studio?
Sure.
1, 2, 3. Oh, night divine, night Christ was born. Oh, night, holy night was born. Rejoice, rejoice, our Savior's born.
Guys, what a perfect way to mark the holiday, talking to you. Thank you so much, and have a wonderful holiday.
All right, same
to you. Merry Christmas.
But I'll be home for Christmas time.
Committed. Their holiday album is called Home for Christmas.
I'll be home for Christmas. You can count on me.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's 8:18 and you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for spending your Christmas morning with us. I'm Terry Bell. Coca-Cola is getting into the milk business. It plans to sell a version of milk with more protein and calcium and no lactose. We'll take you to the Indiana farm where it's made, coming up at 8:33. Our weather forecast today, cloudy and cool with afternoon highs in the 30s.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus, honoring personal legacies in the circle of life. They believe that every detail counts and every memory matters. Piasecki Althaus is located in Kenosha on 39th Avenue, serving the community since 1931.
To make a Kwanzaa placemat and mini gingerbread house, Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support seasonal activities for kids. For more information, visit WPR.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Obama, in his weekly address, is offering thanks to members of the U.S. military and their families for their service on this Christmas Day. Oklahoma Congressman James Lankford is echoing those thoughts in the weekly Republican address.
To all of our military families scattered across the globe this Christmas, thank you for serving far away so millions of American families can be at home today in freedom and safety. Your sacrifice and commitment allow children in my state and across our nation to wake up with peace.
Arizona Senator John McCain is in Afghanistan today, a week before the majority of U.S. and NATO combat troops formally wrap up their mission in that country. The Salvation Army in Massachusetts says coins and dollar bills aren't the only donations that bell ringers are seeing in their red kettles this holiday season. Some people are donating expensive jewelry, including diamond rings, diamond bracelets, and pendants.
Typically expect gift amounts on the scale of $1 to $5. When we see a $20 bill in a red kettle, that's a pretty exciting day. So to have all of these diamonds show up in our kettles has just been absolutely remarkable.
That's Drew Forrester with the Salvation Army. No word yet on what may have caused the crash of a small plane in Northern California. It left two people dead. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell. Police have arrested a South Central Wisconsin woman suspected of stabbing her brother to death. The suspect was involved in a disturbance with her brother at her home in the town of Delton early Monday morning. She allegedly told investigators she stabbed her brother in the chest in self-defense. The Sauk County Sheriff says the woman finally called police a few hours later. Prosecutors are expected to charge her with first-degree murder tomorrow. Police in the Fox Valley are investigating the death of a toddler. The 2-year-old boy was found dead yesterday morning at his home in Kimberly. Officers were initially told it was a medical problem. An autopsy was performed yesterday, but the results were not immediately released. No arrests have been made, and the Fox Valley Metro Police Department is heading the investigation. What would be one of Wisconsin's most festive Christmas displays is hidden inside a house in Eau Claire. That's where Alvin Sieg has more than 1,000 nativity scenes in his basement. The 82-year-old retired teacher began collecting the sets about a decade ago. Many are made from traditional wood or metal. One was made from beeswax and another from computer parts, and one only from salt. Sieg says most of his nativity sets are gifts, but he gets a lot of them after Christmas from different places. He has no plans to stop adding to his collection. Even though his basement is filled with them, he jokes he'll have to start hanging them from the ceiling. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell. More news at 8:42.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, working to improve the quality of people's lives by supporting the performing arts, the environment, medical research, and child well-being. Information is available at ddcf.org. From Novo Nordisk, committed to innovation in diabetes care for over 90 years. More at novonordisk-us.com. From Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering genomic testing that may reveal other treatment options for individual cancer patients at cancercenter.com. And from Margo and John Ernst, supporting North Country Public Radio in Canton, New York, and NPR's environmental coverage, which helps to raise awareness on issues surrounding climate change.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning, I'm David Green. Immigration has been in the news a lot this year. Failed attempts at immigration reform, impassioned debates over the future of people in this country illegally. Well, as this year approaches its end, here's a story of a city doing anything it can to draw immigrants. The city of Pittsburgh, long known for steel mills, a sense of community, and an incredible work ethic, is hoping immigrants can help define the future. Keystone Crossroads' Irina Zhurov reports.
When Amar Nassif was 8 years old in Iraq, he often thought about his future wife and kids, about the car and house and business he'd own. As an adult, he became an electrical engineer and made his 8-year-old self proud.
Before the war, I did many things. My cousins, my friends, my neighbors, they know Amar. He's working, make business. I did very well.
He lost everything when he fled Baghdad suddenly in 2006. Nassif, who's 39, says he received a death threat from terrorists over his work with an American company. They'd already killed an older brother.
I thought I will back to my country after 1 or 2 months, when everything is be saved.
Instead, he spent 2 years in Syria, 2 years in the Netherlands, and 2 years in Jordan. Then he and his family received refugee status and came to Pittsburgh, his final stop.
That, I think, have to be the last station. I'm so tired, I'm done.
Those words are music to Pittsburgh's ears, because Pittsburgh has a plan.
It's 20,000 new residents over the next 10 years. And a portion of that, if we're doing it right, should be immigrants.
Betty Cruz heads Welcoming Pittsburgh, a new initiative to attract and retain newcomers. Studies show immigrants start businesses at a higher rate than non-immigrants, and they can raise home values when they move into neighborhoods. The Brookings Institution's Audrey Singer says programs like Welcoming Pittsburgh come as a reaction to failed immigration reform, but also because depopulated industrial cities see immigrants as an economic development tool.
A lot of these places are looking for two things, economic activity and population. Immigrants and refugees are often looked at as a really dynamic group.
Pittsburgh is just the latest Rust Belt city trying to boost its 7% foreign-born demographic. That's pretty low for an urban area. Philadelphia has a similar program, Chicago, St. Louis, Columbus, Dayton, about 40 cities nationwide in all. Barbara Murrock is with the Allegheny County Department of Human Services. She says Pittsburgh has some catching up to do.
Back in the 80s, when immigration was starting to flow into many other large cities, we were having a real economic crisis here with the steel mills going down. So now that we are starting to have an inward migration, we're really just developing the awareness.
Another thing, the Rust Belt's immigrants are very educated. In a report, Brookings Singer found Pittsburgh has the biggest ratio of high-skilled immigrants in the nation. So people like Nassif need additional help navigating the process of transferring credentials. Things like translating and evaluating degrees and coursework to figure out the quickest way forward.
It's kind of like a maze. It's kind of a difficult process to get through.
About 30,000 high-skilled immigrants are underemployed in Pennsylvania. Nassif currently works as a caregiver, bringing in $1,400 a month plus SNAP benefits to purchase some groceries for a family of five. And some see Pittsburgh as kind of parochial, not necessarily open to outsiders. Welcoming Pittsburgh hopes to change all that by opening government and coordinating various agencies' efforts. Singer says it's too soon to tell if it's working in other cities, but what some call deliberate welcoming enhances the number one thing cities need to have, opportunity. As for Nassif, he's staying positive.
I feel here in Pittsburgh, I can do many dreams what I have. I feel good for future.
He's already bought a house, he's participating in a new program for high-skilled immigrants, and taking English classes. That's all very good news for the comeback city. For NPR News, I'm Irina Zhurov.
This Christmas morning, I have been gathering around a studio with a wonderful staff of colleagues who are working this holiday. Maybe you're gathered around a Christmas tree. And probably the last thing on your mind is how much that tree is worth. But it's a different story for the people who sell them. It's big business. Americans bought over 25 million trees last year, and many were purchased from small farmers. NPR's Eleanor Klibanoff visited a farm in Louisa, Virginia.
Step into the bright red barn at Claybrook Farms, and it feels like Christmas. A pot of hot cider bubbles on the stove. Friends, neighbors, and extended family make wreaths while owner John Carroll hauls in wood for the fire. It's gray outside, but the barn is full of holiday cheer. As Christmas tree farmers, holiday cheer is the Carroll family business. As we leave the warmth of the barn and board the tractor for a tour of the fields, Virginia Carroll tells me this land has been in her family for generations. She and her husband started the Christmas tree business once they were married.
We actually planted our first trees when we were expecting Matthew. And then a little while down the road, we had another son, Tyler, and it just seemed like a good use of the land and a good fit for us.
Matthew and Tyler, now grown, point to their fields. Where Matthew's white pines were first planted, there are just a few overgrown evergreens and an empty field ready for the next planting. The Carrolls, like many farmers, saw the trees as an investment to be cashed in when their children were heading off to college. Christmas trees can generate a good return. Plant about 1,000 seedlings per acre. 400 to 800 of those turn into sellable trees, which can go for $50, $100, or more. And compared to other farm businesses, they're a lot less work.
It seemed like it would be a good idea maybe to have something other than livestock, which had to be fed and cared for on a regular basis.
Christmas trees can take 7 to 12 years to mature, depending on the type. 7 to 12 years if you don't run into drought, deer, invasive species, or any of the other factors that can endanger the young trees. The Carroll family isn't immune to these risks, but John and Matthew are both trained foresters. Virginia has lived on this land her whole life. Matthew's wife, Charlie Gale, is the agriculture teacher at the local high school. As Matthew will tell you, this is a family that knows the care these trees require.
As the tree gets older, you have more trimming to do. When it gets to about 4 or so, we'll need to start using other equipment. We want to keep them looking fairly natural.
What started as an investment crop has turned into a family passion, and the tradition is still growing. Matthew and Charlie Gale had their first child, Coleman, in August. Coleman's college fund will be planted this spring. Eleanor Klibanoff, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
This just in, Spark the Elf has a problem at the office.
I and all the other elves in that division, we spend our whole day watching the surveillance videos of these kids.
Of course.
Pushing the naughty button or the nice button.
Ho, ho, ho.
A special radio drama for this Christmas Day later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 3 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Good morning, I'm David Green. A paramedic in Brazil had seen a lot in his 19 years on the job, but never this. A dog in a race to catch up with his ambulance. The dog's owner had a seizure and was being rushed to the hospital. The pooch was left behind, but determined to catch up. The animal chased the ambulance until the crew stopped and let the dog climb in where the patient was conscious and aware that his dog had caught up. In sickness and in health, really, man's best friend. You're listening to Morning Edition.
It's 8:31. Thanks for listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Terry Bell. Good morning. Well, Sandeep Roy will describe an Indian holiday delicacy that bears a suspicious resemblance to the much maligned fruitcake on Morning Edition at 8:45.
Support for WPR comes from Fontana Sports in Madison, locally owned outdoor shops featuring winter apparel from The North Face, Columbia, and Patagonia, as well as snowshoes, skis, and more. Locations west and downtown. FontanaSports.com.
WGTD broadcasts from studios located on the Kenosha campus of Gateway Technical College. In Kenosha and Racine, WGTD is heard at 91.1 FM, Elkhorn at 101.7, Lake Geneva 103.3, and around the world at WGTD.org.
This is Joy Cardine. I'm headed to Alaska this summer on a holiday vacations tour for WPR listeners. We'll travel through the Inside Passage in Glacier Bay aboard the Norwegian Pearl, stopping in Juneau, Skagway, Ketchikan, and Victoria. We'll take in many sights from gardens and glaciers to railroads. Before we board, there's time to explore downtown Seattle and catch a Prairie Home Companion live at the Chateau St. Michel Winery. Registration is at wpr.org/travel.
Our weather forecast for this Christmas Day, cloudy and cool with highs in the 30s, a chance of snow in the north tonight with lows in the 20s and low 30s. We'll start out with light rain and snow tomorrow, then forecasters say several inches of snow are possible in Wisconsin tomorrow night into Saturday. Right now, Superior 32, Eau Claire 30, La Crosse and Wausau 32, Madison and Green Bay 34. In Milwaukee, it's 36 degrees.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at pewtrusts.org. From the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and developing countries, on the web at lemelson.org. And from Patricia Papper, supporting Perez Art Museum Miami, providing progressive art programming and cultural experiences to Miami-Dade County residents and visitors on the web at pamm.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green. Coca-Cola got a good bit of attention last month when it announced it was going into the milk business. And not just any milk, nutritious, reformulated super milk.
It's like they got Frankenstein to lactate.
Stephen Colbert made fun of Coke's new milk on his show.
And if this product doesn't work out, they can always reintroduce Milk Classic.
But in fact, the idea for this product didn't come from Coke. It was originally the brainchild of some people who run a huge high-tech dairy farm in Indiana, a farm that is also a theme park. NPR's Dan Charles went for a visit.
Driving south from Chicago toward Indianapolis on I-65, just when the flat, endless fields have lulled you into an unthinking stupor, Americana Alert. There's a tank truck parked like a billboard alongside the road. Painted on it, the cryptic words, "We dare you to exit 200. A few hundred yards later, another tank truck billboard, "We double dare you." And then a third tank with two huge fiberglass cows mounted on top of it. It's an invitation to America's one and only mega dairy tourist attraction.
Well, good morning. I want to welcome you to Fair Oaks Farms. This is one of the largest farms in the United States.
Terry Tracy is my guide to Fair Oaks Farms. The whole operation, he explains, covers 16,000 acres. There are 37,000 cows divided among 11 separate milking locations. At the visitor center, there's a small amphitheater where you can watch through a glass wall as cows give birth. A small bus takes visitors to the working part of the farm, right down the middle of a barn that's almost 500 yards long.
The cows are not confined within the pens. They pick their own bed, eat and drink whatever they want, and move around freely.
We see cows eating, standing around, mostly lying in their stalls on beds of sand. We stop at the so-called milking parlor and watch from a balcony as the cows, one by one, step onto a huge rotating turntable to be milked. Sensors identify each cow, and computers record how much milk she's producing.
Take a look. They're calm, cool, collect. Exactly what these farmers want them to be.
Fair Oaks is the frontier of dairying. The people who run this place are so ambitious, they're even changing the milk itself, in partnership with Coke. It's an idea that began years ago when two of the founders of Fair Oaks, Mike and Sue McCloskey, were running a big dairy in New Mexico. They ran into a problem with bad water and had to buy some expensive membranes to filter out impurities. Sue McCloskey says it got them thinking, what could filters do with milk?
Is there something else that we can do with this milk to give it a premium value that we're not thinking about?
They realized filters can divide raw milk into its different parts: protein, lactose, minerals, water. And then you can put the parts back together, but in different proportions. You can make a new recipe for milk, maybe even a better one.
And I remember sitting down with Mike and we were talking about this. And I told him, listen, if you can make a milk that for me as a woman, I could get all of my calcium and a bunch of my protein in one glass or one serving, I mean, holy mackerel, that would be the most awesome thing.
And they created it, a kind of milk with extra protein and calcium, but no lactose. One supermarket chain in Texas sells it as Mootopia. It tastes like a slightly thicker, richer version of milk. Now Coca-Cola is on board. It has joined forces with Fair Oaks Farms and the cooperative that owns it, Select Milk Producers. Together, they're launching that line of milk-derived milk alternatives next month. Dan Charles, NPR News.
What better time than Christmas to hear about a very cold part of the Earth where mysterious things take place? Not the North Pole, the Mariana Trench. It cuts a 1,500-mile swath at the bottom of the Pacific Ocean near the island of Guam. And an international team of scientists has just spent over a month sending probes down to the deepest place on the planet. The scientists were stunned by the amount of life they found there, including the deepest known fish. NPR's Christopher Joyce has more.
7 miles below the ocean's surface, the trench lies in perpetual darkness and freezing cold. To explore it, scientists aboard the research vessel Falco dropped landers over the side. Each one is about the size of a big refrigerator and bristles with instruments and cameras. The landers use thick glass spheres full of air to control their up and down movement. The spheres have to withstand pressures that would crush a human like a tin can.
If they crack, they implode in a microsecond.
Biologist Jeff Drazen of the University of Hawaii was a senior scientist on the team.
And that sets off a shockwave like a stick of dynamite going off.
And that's just what happened to one lander. The implosion was recorded by its microphone, and in those cold depths, the sound kept echoing along the trench. The lander survived, as did all but one of the others. Once on the bottom, they waited and watched. And they got some big surprises.
We saw the deepest living fish ever recorded. Definitely something new. We took one look at the thing and were amazed. Big, wide, wing-like fins, this eel-like tail, and this scalloped face. It was very unique.
It appeared to be a new species of snailfish living 5 miles below the surface. The landers also carried baited traps that actually caught another new species of fish and brought several of them back to the ship, although they didn't survive the decompression. The scientists also wanted to know what lives in the bottom sediment. It's made of decomposed ocean life that constantly drifts down from above like snow. The landers dug into the sediment and measured the respiration rate of microbes in it. Drazen says the results were astonishing.
The rates were really high. It was incredible. It was really cooking.
All in all, the trench turned out to be a biological hotspot. Paul Yancey is a team biologist from Whitman College.
It's looking like there's a lot more life down there than we thought. You know, this is so far from the sunlight, people thought there wouldn't be a lot of life down there, but there is.
Yancey says one reason appears to be the fact that the trench is truly the bottom of the planet. Things end up there the way they do at the bottom of a purse.
It's looking like these trenches might act like funnels to collect stuff from all over the oceans that's sinking down.
Stuff that sustains animals, if they can adapt to this hostile environment. Yancey says that's what biologists live for, the chance to find crazy new stuff.
Well, I think the big picture is there's so much about our planet we don't know yet. I mean, literally, we have better maps of the moon and even Mars than we do of most of the deep sea.
Scientists will be back to the trench. The Schmidt Ocean Institute, which operates the team's research vessel, is building a remotely operated vehicle that will be able to travel along the bottom. Then the scientists won't have to wait for deep sea dwellers to come to them. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's 8:41. Thanks for joining us on Wisconsin Public Radio this morning. I'm Terry Bell. The Marketplace Morning Report in 10 minutes. Will falling oil prices slow down green energy investments? Our weather for today, cloudy and cool with afternoon highs in the 30s. There's a chance of several inches of snow in Wisconsin starting tomorrow night and going into Saturday.
Enjoy festive programming on Wisconsin Public Radio throughout the holiday season. You'll hear music from around Wisconsin and around the world. Dickens' classic A Christmas Carol and the annual New Year's concert from Vienna. Learn more about all of our holiday shows at wpr.org/holidays.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Christmas Day at the Vatican, where thousands turned out on St. Peter's Square to hear Pope Francis deliver his annual message. He urged people not to be indifferent to suffering around the world. The Pope also called for an end to the violent conflicts in Africa and for dialogue between Israel and the Palestinians. He condemned Taliban militants for last week's attack on a military-run school in Pakistan. It left nearly 150 people dead, mostly students. It's snowing in Moscow today, though most Russians aren't celebrating a white Christmas.
Moscow is usually pretty efficient when it comes to dealing with snow, but this storm dumped snow so fast that the city services couldn't keep up. There were massive traffic jams in the city center, and more than 150 flights were delayed at the city's three airports. So far, the airports haven't shut down, and officials expect to get air traffic back on schedule by tomorrow. Today is not a holiday for most Russians who celebrate Christmas on January 7th.
That's NPR's Corey Flintoff in Moscow. There were Christmas Eve protests and a vigil in Berkeley, Missouri, in the aftermath of Tuesday night's fatal police shooting. An officer shot and killed 18-year-old Antonio Martin at a gas station after police say he pointed a gun at the officer. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell. Two men from Wisconsin have been identified as the victims of a fatal accident in Lake Superior near a resort in Minnesota. The Cook County Sheriff's Department says Evan Johnson of Menominee and Wayne Hoffman of Spring Green died Tuesday afternoon near the Bluefin Bay Resort. According to the official account, Johnson fell into the water first. Hoffman was pulled in by a wave as he tried to rescue Johnson. A security guard at University of Wisconsin Hospital in Madison has been charged with five counts of sexual assault as a child. Matthew Tweed of Belleville was charged Monday in Greene County. Tweed has been placed on administrative leave from the hospital with pay until the matter is resolved. Hospital says he was hired in 2009. Background checks conducted at that time and last year did not reveal any criminal record or cause for concern. Hospital also says there's no evidence Tweed engaged in any inappropriate conduct involving children at the hospital at any time. Tweed is scheduled to appear in court next week. Well, Wisconsinites will attend community Christmas dinners, but none larger than at the Wisconsin Center Ballroom in downtown Milwaukee, where 8,000 meals are expected to be served today. It's the 25th anniversary of Milwaukee's Family Feast, which started in 1990. The Salvation Army of Wisconsin and Upper Michigan arranges 1,400 volunteers to serve. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the estate of Joan Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio. From Ford, the maker of the C-Max Hybrid, with 5-passenger seating and 188 total system horsepower. Ford, go further. And from Patricia Papper, supporting Perez Art Museum Miami, providing progressive art programming and cultural experiences to Miami-Dade County residents and visitors. On the web at pamm.org.
Merry Christmas. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green. Here in the United States, there is a certain holiday delicacy that could be best described as a mixed blessing. The traditional, extremely heavy fruitcake studded with neon-bright candied fruit is more likely to be a punchline than a favorite treat. But in India, commentator Sandeep Roy says the fruitcake is held in much higher regard.
Denzel Saldana is over 80, but far from retired.
Hello. Mr. Banerjee. Hey, give me your bread order.
He takes orders surrounded by workers cutting slices of fruitcake with thick almond icing.
I'm making also chocolate walnut.
This family bakery is making 600,000 pounds of cake this Christmas. Denzel's daughter, Deborah, who gave up banking to join the family business, says customers appreciate that it's all made to order.
They get the smell of hot cakes coming out of the oven and, you know, literally wafting in the air.
There's raisins, there's plums, cashews, peel, lemon peel, red peel, white preserves.
And the most famous Indian rum.
Triple X rum, Old Monk.
The British are long gone, but they left behind the fruitcake. The West jokes about indestructible fruitcakes as the gift that keeps on giving, but Calcutta embraces it.
Plum cake, fruitcake,
Fleury's, a legendary European-style tea room, stays open all night on Christmas Eve, says manager Rajiv Khanna.
It's a plum cake, which has been marinated just last week of November. The Dundies, rum and raisin, mince pie.
Here in Calcutta, Christmas is simply called Borodin, or Big Day, and it's universal.
I guess Christmas is celebrated by everybody, irrespective of whatever religion they belong to.
Cake knows no religion. At Nahum's, the city's only Jewish bakery, a lady who gave her name only as Mrs. Maxwell waits in a long line as her grandson plays with a toy pistol.
Nothing beats Nahum. You buy the same plum cake from somewhere else at a much higher price, and you buy one from here, you'll immediately find the difference.
At Sheikh Nuruddin's storefront bakery, there's a photograph of Mecca on the wall. But in December, you can rent his oven and his baker's for your own Christmas cake. The shop turns out 7 cakes an hour, 18 hours a day. At Christmas, these small bakeries give customers what the big chains can't, a personalized, homemade feeling. Saldana's will open even on Christmas Day for that last-minute, desperate walk-in.
You can't say no because people come in and you can't send them back disappointed. They have such a sad face.
Jewish bakeries and Muslim bakers in a predominantly Hindu city baking Christmas cakes round the clock. You could call it a triumph of capitalism or a slice of peace and goodwill for all with almond icing.
Commentator Sandeep Roy is the author of the upcoming novel, Don't Let Him Know. He's also a senior editor with FirstPost.com in India. And if you want more than fruitcake, you can find more Christmas food traditions from around the globe at our food blog, The Salt. That's at NPR.org. You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's just about 10 minutes before 9 o'clock, and you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Terry Bell. Good morning. At 9 o'clock, holiday favorites from Wisconsin Public Radio. At 12 noon, a festival of nine lessons and carols. It's a repeat of yesterday's broadcast. And at 2 o'clock this afternoon, a Christmas carol with Jonathan Winters. You can find updates and see our complete holiday program schedule at WPR.org/holidays.
WGTD is owned and operated by Gateway Technical College and is an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio and NPR. To learn more and to take full advantage of our services, visit WGTD.org. To have a program schedule mailed to you, call 262-564-3030.
Live in Madison. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support free, family-friendly activities. For more information, visit WPR.org/events.
The weather on this Christmas Day should be cloudy and cool with highs in the 30s. We're keeping an eye on the weather tomorrow night and Saturday. Several inches of snow, a possibility at this point.
Support for WPR comes from contributing members. 50,000 individuals and families in Wisconsin and beyond who invest in WPR's diverse schedule of news, music, talk, and entertainment programs. Thank you.
Support for WGTD comes from Vero International Cuisine in Racine on 6th Avenue near Monument Square, featuring American food with an international twist in a serene setting with intimate and exotic touches. Online at verointernationalcuisine.com.
As we pump cheaper gasoline this holiday, a look at how low fossil fuel prices don't necessarily undercut renewable energy businesses.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM, I'm David Brancaccio in Washington today. Last June, the average price of crude oil was $105 a barrel. Using the Texas price on this Christmas Day, it is less than $56. Among the effects, cheap oil is undercutting investments in some green technologies. Toyota reports that sales of its high-mileage Prius hybrid are down this year, but low oil prices can, in unusual ways, help wind and solar companies. Marketplace's Dan Weissman reports.
We use oil to make our cars go. Solar and wind generate electricity for homes and businesses. Ethan Zindler is an analyst with Bloomberg New Energy Finance.
So when we talk about renewable technologies like wind and solar, they're not directly competing as a fuel against oil.
Here's how super low oil prices, longer term, could help. It's tricky. You ready? Okay. Oil prices stay low. That means less drilling. And some natural gas comes from places where we also drill for oil. That drilling stops, it reduces natural gas supplies a little, which boosts prices. Meanwhile, demand for natural gas is expected to rise. Wes Mitchell is an analyst for Energy Ventures Analysis.
Gas is going to have a greater share of the electrical power generation stack. That is a fact.
That's because new clean air regulations will likely knock out the other competition, coal. Coal gets knocked out, gas gets more expensive, solar and wind could gain market share. Wes Mitchell, does that sound about right?
Yes.
Bam. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
What are some tells a person is serious about running for president? Republican Jeb Bush is casting off some of his corporate baggage. There's news the former Florida governor and both son and brother of presidents is resigning from the board of Tenet Healthcare. A previous published report said Bush would no longer serve as advisor to Barclays Bank. The maker of Subaru said today it's canceling plans to move production of its crossover vehicle from Japan to the U.S. Fuji Heavy Industries will make the new Subaru XV Crosstrek in Japan. The company suggests it ran into capacity limits at its Indiana plant. After suffering through deindustrialization and the housing crisis, property values and rents are rising again in Detroit. As Marketplace's Adam Allington reports, a surge in job creation has developers scrambling to build rental units, and home values in some neighborhoods are approaching pre-recession levels.
If you're looking for signs that times have changed in the Motor City, look no further than downtown. Wayne State University and companies like Quicken Loans, Little Caesars, and Ford are all expanding, and the demand for apartments far outpaces supply. Developer Richard Barron is the CEO of St. Louis-based McCormick Barron Salazar, which is building 400 new rental units.
The market has firmed up very nicely, certainly for apartments in downtown around the core, and we think that it'll continue to grow.
Even the long-stalled market for single-family houses is beginning to approach pre-recession levels. Ryan Cooley is an agent for O'Connor Real Estate in Detroit's trendy Corktown neighborhood.
If anything, right now our biggest challenge is I have way more buyers than I do like quality housing that people can move into that's like move-in ready.
Despite the good news for downtown, Cooley says many outlying neighborhoods are not seeing the same turnaround. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Two turtle doves, that Partridge, plus the CSI 300 stock index out of Shanghai went up a striking 3.25% today amid reports Chinese regulators are making it easier to lend. The dynamics of this are important. Chinese authorities have been trying to curtail some of the more wild lending practices. But there are reports this week that the Chinese central bank is tweaking its regulations so that banks there are more free in other ways to lend out money. This is about loan-to-deposit ratios. If banks can include more money in the deposits category, then these banks can lend out more, presumably boosting the Chinese economy. The Nikkei in Japan fell 0.25% today. The S&P 500 is one of the wrapped gifts under the tree this morning. It's up just under 15% for 2014.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Constant Contact, committed to helping small businesses and nonprofits meet their goals this holiday season. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. And by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure all students graduate high school prepared to succeed in college and careers.
Imagine the entrepreneur going in for the business loan or begging for venture capital this way. The pitch starts, okay, my business plan will merge two concepts, the old lady who hoards cats, who doesn't love that, and Starbucks. Cafes with real cats purring around are already big in Japan, but this month, cat cafes opened in Denver and in Manhattan. Jeremy Dalmas of KALW in San Francisco stopped by one that was already in business in the Bay Area.
It's 10 a.m., and Sarah Pritchard is at a cafe in Oakland.
Yeah, I got coffee.
But instead of tapping at a computer or chatting with a friend, she's stalking the room looking for the perfect cat to snuggle. We're at the new Cat Town Cafe, the first cat cafe in America.
Okay, I like that one over there.
Which one?
The tabby. Felt like we had a connection.
There are cats sleeping under cat murals, cats pouncing on feather toys. There are even cats climbing on a miniature downtown Oakland. But if you think there'll be a Siamese lounging on the biscotti, think again. The cat zone is separated from the coffee shop by a small hallway. An airlock, or as they call it, a hairlock. Staff from the food area can't enter the cat zone during their shift, and vice versa. But patrons are welcome to bring their food in. That is the point, after all. But Cat Town is not a cafe that has cats. Rather, it's an adoption center that lures in humans with its coffee shop. Founder Anne Dunn explains.
For me, this is cat rescue. First and foremost, the measure for me is how many cats are getting adopted.
Cat Town makes it its mission to find homes for cats that aren't doing well at the shelter.
This hopefully will become a model for cage-free, put them in an environment where they'll thrive and they'll get adopted more quickly.
One cat, a brown tabby named Anchor, had been at the shelter for 4 months. But once here, he found a home within 2 hours. Before the cafe opened, Cat Town adopted out about a dozen felines a month. But after 2 months here, they've adopted 59. Wait, make that 60.
We're gonna get a cat.
Sarah Pritchard just made a new friend, Guthrie.
There in the little bed right now with the yellow eyes.
So watch out. The next time you grab an Americano, you may leave with a new family member. In Oakland, I'm Jeremy Dalmas for Marketplace.
Our feline Dimitri Brancaccio has gone past tall and grande and is now officially a venti cat. It's the Marketplace Morning Report from APM, American Public Media.
It's a minute before 9 o'clock. Thank you for spending your Christmas morning with Wisconsin Public Radio. Our weather forecast today, cloudy and cool with afternoon highs in the 30s. There is a chance of snow in northern Wisconsin tonight.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin Extension, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
Support comes from Gateway. Lock in a job, learn a trade on site and in class, and get paid as you go. Apprenticeships are available in a growing variety of areas, including culinary arts, medical coding, pharmacy tech, and maintenance tech. Call Nikki at 262-564-2952.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha.